This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today, why there are fears for a man's life. He's a convicted murderer who is facing deportation to Papua New Guinea from Australia. More on that in just a moment. Also coming up, days after it was first publicly released, we can now bring you the details of the report into last year's deadly ferry sinking in Kiribati. And it is a damning read, placing much of the responsibility on the ferry's master. And yet many people in Kiribati continue to blame the government.
This government has already dug its pitiless grave. It's gone already. They're dead.
More on that story and more coming up here on Pacific Beach. Good morning, I'm Catherine Grau. Australian authorities are looking to deport a man to Papua New Guinea. He is a convicted murderer, but he's also gravely ill. And his doctor, who's one of Australia's leading surgeons, is warning that his patient could starve within a year if he is sent to PNG. Now, Mark Busser, who is a Papua New Guinean citizen, was put behind bars 14 years ago when he was just 16 years old. His family was living in Australia at the time in the regional city of Newcastle. He's now served his time and has been in an immigration detention centre since he was paroled early last year. Since then, he's been fighting a decision by Australia's Immigration Department, which decided to not grant him a visa so he could join the rest of his family who remain here in Australia. An appeals tribunal has urged a rethink on the decision to have him deported because of his ill health. But as Giselle Wakatama reports, his bid for a protection visa has failed.
Mark Busser left PNG in 2004 and has told the ABC that he has limited or no family ties and would risk living in a shanty town if sent back there.
Basically, I'll be just starting off on the streets and with no money or nothing like that.
In June 2018, the Administrative Appeals Tribunal recommended the Department of Home Affairs rethink its decision not to grant Busser a protection visa due to fears he would die prematurely from ill health or be killed if he was sent back. 16 months on and the department's responded and the decision has not gone Busser's way, with the Minister Peter Dutton deciding to reject the visa. Busser had a third of his pancreas removed while he was in jail in 2007, and he's given approval for his surgeon, Professor Jaz Samrat, to speak exclusively to the ABC. Dr. Samrat is one of Australia's most experienced pancreatic surgeons. He says Busser needs a medication known as Creon to survive, taking 3 tablets for every main meal and 1 with every snack each day.
Certainly he would get wasted within a year if he wasn't taking appropriate medications.
Professor Samra says that wastage would be similar to an HIV sufferer.
In the long and in the short run, I am concerned that his survival is likely to be shortened.
Mark Busser says deportation without access to his medicine would render him prone to infection at risk of wastage within months.
There's no hope at all of getting anywhere close to the medical treatment and care that I'd need to. Basically, survival, definitely is death sentence.
Professor Samra says his fears are heightened since learning of the latest development in Busser's case.
So even if he eats well, he has a healthy diet, he wouldn't be able to absorb it properly.
Professor Samra is keen to stress his comments are not politically motivated and he's only speaking out due to his fears for his patient.
I'm not politically aligned in any way or form. I'm just commenting on, in this case, purely as a patient-doctor relationship sort of on those bases.
The ABC has spoken to pharmacists in Port Moresby who confirm that the availability of Creon in PNG is limited and the drug is also expensive. They say the drug's classed as a special order and sent on request from Australia. One pharmacist instead recommended probiotics that are off script and available on the shelf at local pharmacies. But Professor Samra says Busser needs a prescribed medication to survive.
His ability to produce enzymes to digest food is impaired, so he needs these tablets for the absorption, also breakdown of nutrients in his bowel, so he can absorb them.
The Department of Home Affairs has told the ABC that when making its decision, it took all of the relevant information and circumstances into account, including the impact on the individual and the individual's family and the safety of the Australian community. Basser is prevented from taking his case back to the Appeals Tribunal and says he is instead thinking of a federal court challenge on the grounds that there was jurisdictional error and error in the decision-making process. But the department says Basser fails Australia's character test.
That is Giselle Wakatama reporting there. To Kiribati, where word is slowly filtering out that the government has now published online the report into last year's ferry disaster, and it reveals that 95 people lost their lives in the tragedy. It is a damning read. It finds that the MV Busseroy was unseaworthy, that it was overloaded and, in fact, should not have been carrying any passengers at the time anyway. Now, the report has placed a lot of the responsibility for the tragedy on the ferry's master and operator. But despite that, some in Kiribati believe that many people will continue to blame the government, as Liam Fox reports.
It's been more than a year and a half since the MV Busseroy sank, killing 95 people, the worst maritime accident in Kiribati's history. But former long-time Member of Parliament Patrick Tasiretta says the pain for many people who lost loved ones remains raw.
They're still crying. They put up their lamentations on the songs and everything. And we still have it in us.
The government has now published online the full report of the Commission of Inquiry that investigated the tragedy. It describes in harrowing detail the last moments of the ferry and most of those on board. Soon after it left the island of Nonos for the 240-kilometre journey to the capital Tarawa, the main structural crossbeam began to fail. 2 hours later, the hulls began to separate and the cabin and wheelhouse collapsed and sank. Passengers and crew scrambled to get into the two inflatable lifeboats, but one was punctured on the wreckage, the floor of the other failed, and people were left hanging onto inflatable tubes. Those that could got into two dinghies. One of the dinghies capsized and sank 3 days later. By the time a New Zealand search and rescue plane spotted the remaining dinghy, 10 days after the ferry left Nonos, there were only 7 survivors. Of the 95 people who perished, 23 of them were children. One was a pregnant mother who died while giving birth. Patrick Tasiretta says many people blame the government.
This government has already dug its pitiless grave. It's gone already. They're dead.
That's despite the report attributing a lot of the blame to the ferry's master. He ignored a notice by a marine surveyor not to carry passengers. He failed to let maritime authorities know he was departing Nonos as required. He refused to turn the catamaran around when its main structural beam cracked loudly just out from Nonos. He switched off the generator that powered the ferry's radio. He failed to issue a distress message when the boat started to break up. During the scramble to get into the lifeboats, the report said he failed to perform his leading role. He was sitting on one of the capsized hulls, dazed, regretful and sorry. Opposition MP England Utah says it will take a while for the report's findings to filter out into the community, but he believes many people will continue to blame maritime authorities and the government for the loss of so many lives.
Since the Marine Division was not there to sort of monitor the departure of the vessel and even passengers boarding the vessel when it issued that order, the order not to carry passengers, who else should we blame for that?
The actions and inactions of the ferry's operator and maritime authorities are also mentioned in the report. The ferry had run aground twice before its final voyage, but the commission said the extent of the damage could not be determined. It was also unseaworthy because its radio licence had expired, and the communication system was not fully functional. The report said the operator, TOK's holding company, also contributed to the delay in launching the search and rescue operation. It failed to provide authorities with adequate information early on, refused to accept responsibility, provided false and misleading information to the commission, and showed no concern for the safety of passengers and crew. Mr. Utah says now the report is out, the next step is to hold someone legally responsible for the tragedy.
I think the main issue now is that this matter should be referred to report, I guess, because that's what we've been arguing all along from our side in the opposition. Somebody has to be held accountable.
Thoughts of England Yuta. He's an opposition MP in Kiribati. Liam Fox reporting there for us. Well, just weeks after Taiwan lost two of its crucial diplomatic allies in the Pacific, it has co-hosted the first ever high-level forum. It's known as the Pacific Islands Dialogue, along with US government officials. And Taiwan's foreign minister has used the opportunity to take a swipe at China, accusing it of authoritarian expansionism in the Pacific. Of course, the Solomon Islands in Kiribati last month ditched their long-standing relations with the government in Taipei to instead recognise China. Now, China claims that Taiwan is its own province and therefore has no right to these kind of state-to-state relations. Taiwan has since accused Beijing of poaching its allies, which now stand at just 4 in the Pacific of 15 globally. The top diplomat who was leading the US delegation at yesterday's dialogue was Sandra Oudkirk. She sent a message that many say was meant for Beijing when she said that development financing should not result in unsustainable debt. Now, her presence at the meeting in Taiwan was considered to be a rather rare event and interpreted by many as a show of strong US support for Taiwan. It is a curious situation because the United States, of course, actually officially recognises China, not Taiwan, but it provides assistance to the government in Taipei. Now, Kuei Bo Huang is the Vice Dean at the College of International Affairs at the National Cheng Chi University in Taiwan. I spoke with him earlier for his take on yesterday's Pacific Dialogue.
The Pacific Island Dialogue is unusual in the sense that in the past, such an event or such an coordination mechanism between Taiwan and the United States was on the table. But today, people can see it in Taipei. So my personal explanation is that the U.S. and the Taiwan government would like to make this topic more salient for further discussion or for further thinking in Taiwan society so that people in Taiwan can pay more attention to Taiwan's diplomatic ties with these Pacific Island countries, which are also of great importance for U.S. Indo-Pacific strategy. And that is an indicator that the U.S. has felt very much concerned about the current developments in the Pacific, because in the past, Taiwan had 6 diplomatic allies in the Pacific region, which constituted a strong defense for U.S. national interest. But Taiwan has lost the Solomon Islands and Kiribati. These two countries and their leaving indicates the weakening influence of the U.S. government towards the region. I'm not saying that the U.S. has lost all of its influence, but I think for specific cases, the U.S. has figured out its influence has been waning.
Now, there's been some commentary and observations of this summit saying that it was largely about the U.S. trying to help shore up support for Taiwan. How much do you think this dialogue was about maintaining the relationship that it has now with the 4 remaining Pacific allies, or concern perhaps that they will otherwise follow the lead of Solomon Islands and Kiribati? We've seen certainly Tuvalu and Marshall Islands pledge their commitment publicly for Taiwan in recent weeks since those switches, but much less has been said by Nauru and particularly Palau, which also we understand reportedly didn't send a representation to this dialogue.
I think you are right, because right now Taiwan has had only 4 diplomatic allies in the region, that is Marshall Islands, Palau, Nauru, and Tuvalu, 2 of which are not that stable in terms of bilateral exchanges. So I think this would be a big concern at the Pacific Island Dialogue in Taipei, that both Taiwan and the U.S. would like to stake some efforts to make sure that Taiwan can maintain stable and helpful relations with these 4 diplomatic allies in the Pacific region.
It is Kuei Bo Huang. He lectures in American foreign policy at the National Cheng Chi University in Taiwan.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, scuba divers will have heard of the term upwelling. For those who don't know, though, it's when cold water rises up from the deep ocean floor, bringing with it rich nutrients that can help the coral grow. It's not understood, though, how often that process happens in the Coral Sea off of Australia's northeast coast and to the south of Papua New Guinea. So now a team of scientists on board an Australian science research vessel have been trying to answer that and find out if climate change is playing a role. Emily Grammins reports.
On the main deck of the Australian research vessel Investigator, scientists are using underwater equipment to pump seawater from the ocean below. It's collected at multiple points to measure its characteristics at different depths.
Where's your offset? 400 D-bar.
Copy that.
Dirk Erler from the University of Southern Cross is processing the seawater samples. When he gets them back to the lab, he's hoping to discover how much nitrogen the samples contain.
Nitrogen's important for all biological growth, so organisms need nitrogen to grow. And the deep ocean contains about 70% of all the world's biologically available nitrogen. So it's a huge source of nutrition for the corals that live on the edge of the barrier reef.
The nitrogen is delivered to the corals through a natural process called upwelling, where the nutrient-rich colder water from the deep ocean rises to the surface. The researchers are hoping their analysis will give them vital information about how that process feeds the reef.
We don't really have a handle on the frequency at which nitrogen is delivered to the barrier reef through upwelling.
They also want to find out if upwelling is actually contributing to global warming. Oceans are the largest carbon sink on the planet, and these water samples will be analysed for greenhouse gases stored deep in the coral sea.
When those gases reach the surface, they will enter the atmosphere. A lot of those gases are consumed as the water is upwelled onto the shelf, but sometimes they can actually make it into the atmosphere. So we're collecting water samples, we extract the gas out of it, and we measure how much is in there. And that hasn't really been done along the coral sea before.
To get a more complete picture, they're measuring greenhouse gases in the air as well. That's the task of PhD student Tom Glaze, who set up a special piece of equipment up on deck.
As we move along the coral sea adjacent to the Queensland coast, we also have a Picaro active, which effectively measures atmospheric concentrations of several greenhouse gases, including methane, CO2 and 2O. To determine the background concentrations of these greenhouse gases.
The researchers say climate change, which has brought warmer waters and stronger ocean currents, has likely changed the pattern of upwelling. This study will help them ascertain the extent of that change and what that might mean for the future of the Great Barrier Reef.
As Emily Grammins reporting there, well, an all-female crew is preparing to embark on a two-year round-the-world sailing voyage, including to the Pacific, where they're going to be investigating the causes of, but also solutions to, ocean plastic pollution. They're going to journey more than 38,000 nautical miles and plan on sailing to several of the floating plastic rubbish patches that exist. Emily Penn is heading up the voyage, and she spoke with Beverly O'Connor.
It's a cause that I discovered actually about 12 years ago when I was on my way from the UK to Australia and planning to live over there. And I ended up seeing this plastic in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And life really hasn't been the same since, as we've been working on trying to solve it. The thing about being out there is I first went out doing scientific research expeditions, actually looking for these islands in the centre of the accumulation zones. But it turns out it's more like a fine soup. You can't see a lot from the surface, just a piece here and a piece there. But what's alarming is that when we take a fine mesh net across the surface of that ocean, we pull up hundreds of fragments of microplastics.
So the plastics are breaking down, but probably more deadly and more dangerous to the bird life and the ocean life.
Exactly. We now find fish are eating it, and it's microscopically small. And we're also now starting to understand that it's sinking. There's very little that we know about what's happening when it gets down there. So part of the scientific work that we will be doing on this voyage is also looking at the water column and the sediment to really understand more about the impact of this issue.
So you raise solutions. Are there solutions? Are there solutions that people are embracing?
There are. A lot of the science work we're doing is just trying to pinpoint where those solutions lie. You know, what plastic is out there, which industry is it coming from, and therefore how to solve it on land, which is where this all begins. But there's so many things that we can all be doing as individuals, minimising our own single-use plastic consumption, and also new technologies and new systems.
You're coming to the Pacific as well, and we're seeing evidence that, in fact, many parts of the Pacific are embracing this one-use plastic form, probably more than others. How concerning is it? What sort of efforts do we have to look at in Australia and in the Pacific?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, plastic is this amazing material that preserves our food. It's so useful, but unfortunately, it's a material that lasts pretty much forever, and we use it so often just to be used once, and it really is that mismatch of design. So where there's no waste management, no closed-loop systems, you know, it really is becoming a huge problem, especially in the Pacific Islands, which is where I first came across this issue. So there's lots of work to do, but there's certainly lots and lots more people ready to do that work.
Well, finally this morning on Pacific Beach, two big rugby league international matches featuring Tonga against Great Britain at the end of this month and against Australia in November remain in jeopardy. But if they do go ahead, the controversial former Australian Wallabies player Israel Folau could yet play a part for the Tongan side, the Mate Mar. Now, after weeks of political infighting over who's actually in control of rugby in Tonga, the country's Supreme Court has now ruled in favour of the Tongan National Rugby League that had been suspended by the world governing body. To explain all the ins and outs of this story, here's Richard Hewitt.
Questioned about the Tongan situation by the media in Sydney, the chairman of the Australian Rugby League Commission, Peter Beattie, seemed to think matters had been dealt with and the Mate Mar were back on track.
We withdrew the invitation to the former administration in terms of the Nines, and we have invited a Tonga team, and there will be a full-strength Tonga team, and the same will go for the test squad, so we're not concerned about that. There are some issues in Tonga. The former administration, the current administration, depending on how you want to describe it, they've got some issues in court, but that will not affect there being a full Tonga team.
But the former Queensland Premier either didn't know or overlooked the fact that the courts have intervened in Nuku'alofa. And William Edwards, the secretary of the TNRL, says they came down firmly on their side.
The only way that that court order is going to be set aside is if the government can show the court that they've got jurisdiction to remove the power of the governing body and give it to another governing body without proper cause, without authority, without statutory authority, without jurisdiction. And they can't do it because I've already spoken to the Solicitor General. They've got no powers underneath our laws in Tonga to take the governing authority off TNRL.
So in practice, what that would appear to mean is the suspension imposed on the TNRL by the Rugby League International Federation is void. But what's not clear is whether that means teams under the TNRL's control will be allowed to take to the field in the big-ticket test matches and the World Rugby League Nines tournament. William Edwards says they have a new coach for the Nines in the form of Anthony Barnes from the Bulldogs in Australia, and a number of coaches apparently putting their hands up for the test matches after Frank Endicott walked away, he said, because of the politics. Talking of which, key to the RLIF's move against the TNRL was the intervention of the interim Prime Minister Simisi Sika, who was part of the previous board that was sacked on the orders of a court in January. He's out of the picture now, so what does the new Prime Minister, Pohuwe Tuinatua, make of the situation? William Edwards says he was summoned to a meeting.
When I went with the Prime Minister, I responded to him saying, I'm sorry, Prime Minister, the law's the law. You people are interfering with our legal and statutory rights. He accepted that. I received a copy of the orders. I had the copy served on him, and the Prime Minister agreed to not to sign any document trying to take away those rights, and then not even file anything with the court to set aside the orders as of yet.
An added twist to the Tonga Rugby League saga comes in the form of Israel Folau. He's put his hand up to play for the Mate Mar and volunteered to keep his mouth closed. And William Edwards says neither the RLIF or the NRL should be looking to punish the player over his dispute in a different code with Rugby Australia.
We've submitted his name. Whether they're going to accept it or not, like, I can't say, but we're definitely going to submit his name because this board doesn't feel that he's done anything wrong in terms of rugby league and has committed no offences underneath rugby league, and there's been no breach notice issued against him in rugby league. All we've heard of is that the NRL refuses to register his name. And I would have thought that you only refuse to register someone's name if they've committed a breach of the rules.
Meanwhile, back in Sydney and still apparently unaware of who has the legal powers to run the game in Tonga, Peter Beattie has spelt out where he sees rugby league going in the Pacific over the next few years.
The vision and out of this is really simple. In 5-10 years, you'll have test quality teams out of Tonga, Samoa, Fiji, PNG, and then you add New Zealand, Australia, and POMs coming down from time to time, you've got a really dynamic competition.
But the reality would appear to be if the RIF and TNRL don't resolve their issues soon, the test matches against Great Britain and Australia could fall by the wayside. And if that happens, Tonga's rise up the world ladder will certainly stall and could go backwards.
But it's Richard Hewitt reporting there, an unfolding story. We'll continue to keep an eye on it for you. Otherwise, that's all for Pacific Beat this morning. I'm Catherine Grau. Have a great day.